I'd like to welcome everybody here to Sabbath. Somewhat different being in the newly renovated room. It would be nice once we have the burgundy carpet here. I'm sure it'll help. A few weeks ago, I gave a message entitled Difficult Passages. Thought I'd continue that this Sabbath. It's extremely important, I believe, as believers, that we understand Yahweh's word and aren't deceived by false beliefs, false doctrines, deception. You know, Hosea, chapter 4, verse 6, prophesied that Yahweh's people were destroyed for lack of knowledge. They rejected that knowledge that they once had. Paul in 2 Timothy 2:15 said to study, to show yourself approved unto Elohim, a workman that needs not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. Also, Ephesians 4:14, Paul gave this warning, that we henceforth be no more children tossed to and fro, and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the sleight of men and cunning craftiness, whereby they lie in wait to deceive. So we find through the word that we're encouraged to study, to search out, to understand the truths of Yahweh's word. This is an obligation we agreed on when we underwent the waters of immersion, baptism, when we dedicated our lives to our Father in heaven and our Savior. We agreed. We obligated ourselves to the study of His Word every day. So let's begin. Let's open up to the Word. Turn to Romans chapter 3, verse 28. I'd like to start there. Romans chapter 3, verse 28. And here's what Paul says. Therefore, we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. Now, many people will say that we are justified apart from the law, which we are, but that negates the requirements. We're no longer under the law. We're no longer obligated to the law. We're free from the law. Now, is this true? Again, we know that we're justified apart from the works of the law. We cannot be justified by our own righteousness. Why? Because we are all sinners. We are all sinners. We're all deserving of death, according to Scripture. Not one of us here is worthy and can achieve salvation on our own. But this does not negate, this does not do away with the requirements of Yahweh's word, with His law, with His Torah, with the requirements, with the yardstick that we use to define righteousness. Now, how do we know this? Let's look at verse 20. What does verse 20 say here? Romans chapter 3, verse 20. Therefore, by the deeds of the law shall no flesh be justified in His sight. Again, we're not justified by the law. To do such a thing, we would have to walk without a blemish, as Yahshua did. And we know we certainly don't fit that qualification. So we are not justified by the law. But Paul goes on and says, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. The knowledge of sin. So the law defines sin, it defines transgression, it defines right and wrong. 1 John 3:4 says sin is the transgression or breaking of the law. So we know that through the law we know what sin is. We know what qualifies as sin. Without the law we have no knowledge of what? We have no knowledge of sin, no knowledge of iniquity, no knowledge of transgression, no knowledge of right and wrong. So this is the purpose and reason for the law, to define sin, to define right living, to define Yahweh's requirements for you and I. It's not that it saves us. It's not that we find salvation through the law. We are saved through faith, but we are saved also through our obedience and our willingness to comply to Yahweh's will. Does faith do away with the law? Look at verse 31. Do we then make void the law through faith? What does Paul say? Elohim forbid. Yea, we establish the law. So Paul asks here at the very end, do we then throw out the law through faith? Does faith make void the law? And Paul said, no way, absolutely not. The word void is kataio in the Greek, means to render idle or useless according to Strong's. The Thayer's Greek lexicon has a more complete definition. Here's what it says: to render idle, unemployed, inactive, inoperative, to cause a person or thing, or to have no further efficiency. To deprive of force, influence, of power. To cause disease, to put an end to do away with, to annul, to abolish, to cease, to pass away, to be done away, to be severed from, to be separated from. That's what the word void here means. To annul, to abolish, to do away. And Paul asks, do we do this with the law? Do we abolish the law? Do we do away with the law? Do we sever the law? And Paul said, absolutely not. He said, no, we establish the law. That word in the Greek is hestemi, means to stand. Again, the Thayer's Greek lexicon says to cause, to make, to stand, to place, to put, to set, to make firm, to fix, to establish. To establish a thing, to cause it to stand, to uphold or sustain the authority or force of anything. So we find that through Paul, that he's saying, through the law, through faith, we establish the law. Not only establish, but according to the Thayer's Greek lexicon, we uphold or sustain the authority or force of Yahweh's word. So certainly faith does not negate, does not do away with Yahweh's word. Let's take a look at Romans chapter 4, verse 15. Romans chapter 4, verse 15. It says, because the law worketh wrath, for where no law is, there is no transgression. So what is this saying? Paul's simply saying again, when you have no law, you have no transgression. So what must you have to have sin? You must have the law. You must have Yahweh's Torah. Now, do we still find evidence of sin in this world? We find evidence of sin on the TV and on the radio, walking down the street, going to work, in every aspect of our lives. We find sin. So, if we have sin, what else must we have? The law, Yahweh's word. Because again, Paul says, to have sin, you must also have the law. You can't have sin without the law. Simply can't happen. Turn to Romans chapter 7 now. Romans talks a lot about faith, talks a lot about grace. Also talks about a lot about the law, how Yahweh's law works and how it's used, why it's used, and what way it's used. Verse 7 says, what then? What shall we say then? Is the law sin? So Paul asks, is the law sin? And what does he say? Elohim forbid. Nay, I had not known it sin, but by the law, for I had not known the lust, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. Drop down to verse 12 now. Now tell me if this sounds like a man who is anti-law. Wherefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good. Well, that's what Paul says about the law. He says it's holy, he says it's just, and he says it's good. So we find here that through the law we know and understand sin. Paul said that if it wasn't for the law, he would not know what coveting was. Same thing goes with all the law. We would not know what stealing. We would know nothing about lying. We know nothing about adultery, fornication. It's because of what we see in our world that we have the problems. We've forsaken Yahweh's word. We've forsaken the law. And look at our culture today. What do we see? You know, it's a mess. It's just a mess. People don't know right from wrong. They don't know what fornication is. People get married or have children out of wedlock, I should say. It's a mess. And why? People don't care. The standards are no longer here in this nation. People have forgotten about the law. Because again, that is the only place we find right from wrong. We know what is right. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not murder. Without the law, we have no knowledge of sin. So we understand that our redemption is through faith, through grace, and Yahshua's propitiation in his sacrifice and his atonement and his blood. But again, this does not negate the law. in many ways, it only strengthens the law, because then we have a greater purpose to look to. And it's through that law that we know right from wrong, that we know how to meet that yardstick that Yahweh's put for each one of us here. I want to move on to our second passage. By the way, I plan to look at 10 today. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 25. This is another common misunderstood passage. It says, "Whatsoever sold in the shambles, that eat, asking no questions for conscience' sake. For the earth is Yahweh's and the fullness thereof. If any of them that believe not bid you to a feast, and you are disposed to go, whatsoever set before you, eat, asking no question for conscience' sake." Now, I've heard people use this passage to justify eating pork and other unclean meat. After all, what do we find here? Paul says that we're not to ask any questions, that we're simply to buy and eat. We're not to be concerned with it. And I guess the question is, what is Paul talking about here? Is he talking about Yahweh's dietary food laws, pork, swine, shellfish, and other unclean food? Or is he talking about something else here? Let's find out. Whenever we're looking at passages like this one here, we need to understand one key truth, and that is context. We must understand context. We must look at the entire passage. We can't pick one or two verses out and build a doctrine on that. We need to look at the whole of the passage. Let's go back to verse 19. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 19. Again, this is Paul speaking, "But I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to Elohim. And I would not that you should have fellowship with devils. You cannot drink the cup of the master and the cup of devils. You cannot be partakers of Yahweh's table and the table of devils. Do you provoke Yahweh to jealousy? Are we stronger than he?" Drop down now to verse 27. "If any of them that believe not bid you to a feast, and you are disposed to go, whatsoever set before you, eat, asking no questions for conscience' sake." Verse 28. "But if a man say unto you, this is offered in sacrifice unto idols, eat not, for his sake that showed it, and for conscience' sake. For the earth is Yahweh's in the fullness thereof." This passage is not speaking about unclean food. It's not speaking about swine. It's not speaking about the dietary food laws we find in Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy chapter 14. This passage is referring to food sacrificed to idols. This was common. They would sacrifice their meat, their food, to an idol. They would bring it back. They would sell it in the marketplace. And you would never know. You had no knowledge of what was sacrificed and what was not sacrificed. Barnes notes, I thought had a good note here, and I want to read it. It says, "The meat of animals offered in sacrifice would be exposed there to sell as well as other meat. The apostle says that it might be purchased, since the mere fact that it had been offered in sacrifice could not change its quality or render it unfit for use. They were to abstain from attending on the feasts of the idols in the temple, from partaking of meat that had been offered them, and from celebrations observed expressly in honor of idols. But lest they should become too scrupulous, the apostle tells them that if the meat was offered indiscriminately in the market with other meat, they were not to hesitate to purchase it or eat it." So again, we're not talking about clean or unclean meat. We're talking about clean meat that was sacrificed to some sort of idol and then taken to the marketplace and sold. And Paul's simply saying, don't worry about it. If they bring it to your knowledge, don't eat it. But otherwise, don't worry about it. Purchase what you need and eat it. Don't worry about it, Paul says. So again, this has absolutely nothing to do with the clean food laws. Nothing to do with the dietary food laws. But everything to do with pagan idolatry. Sacrificing food and meats to idols, to lifeless idols. And then taking that and selling it in the marketplace. I'd like to move on to our third passage, Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 13. And this is a real common misconception here. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 13. I'd like to read this first from the NIV. It says, by calling this covenant new, he made the first one obsolete. Obsolete. And what is obsolete and aging will soon disappear. Now, according to the NIV, the new covenant was made obsolete. The new covenant made the old obsolete. Now, the Webster's Dictionary defines obsolete as, quote, no longer in general use, fallen into disuse, no longer in use. So is the old covenant obsolete? Is it no longer valid? Is it no longer obligatory? Is it no longer necessary? Is it no longer enforced? What is the status of the old covenant or the old testament? Is it null and void through the new? Many people would like you to believe this. People would like you to believe that through the new, we are now no longer obligated to the old. But is this the truth in Yahweh's word? Is this the truth? Well, let's find out. I'd like to read from the KJV. Many of you know that I'm not a real big fan of the NIV. The King James says in verse 13, and that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth, or the Greek says growing old, is ready to vanish away. So from this passage, we find that the Old Testament is decaying. It's growing old, but it's not obsolete. Because remember, what does obsolete mean? It means it's useless. It's no longer required. It doesn't have any use anymore. Certainly, the Old Covenant is not obsolete, but it is growing old. It is growing old. But the Old Covenant is still required. It's still in use. It's the foundation of Yahweh's Word. Matter of fact, according to the evidence we find here in Hebrews, the fulfillment of the New Covenant has yet to happen. Many people don't understand that. They don't understand that the New Covenant has yet to be fulfilled. Let's look back at a few verses here. Verse 10 says, for this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith Yahweh. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts. And I will be to them an Elohim, and they shall be to me a people. So we find here that even in the new covenant that he writes those laws within our hearts and minds. The new covenant does not annul, does not set aside the law that we find in the old. It reinforces it. It's a greater promise. Verse 11. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, know Yahweh. For all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. So according to this passage, which is taken from Jeremiah 31, it's a prophetic passage, the new covenant will be fulfilled when all people will know Yahweh. Says here that you won't go to your neighbor, you won't go to your friend, you won't go to your associate and say, know Yahweh. Because all will know him at this time. All will know Yahweh. We know that this will happen in the millennium. When Yahweh's kingdom is set upon every mountain, every hill. When Yahweh's kingdom is established above all. And all the earth, it says, will flow to his mountain to receive his word. And at this time, all people will know Yahweh. And know his word. But at this time, we have yet to see this fulfilled. We have yet to see the new covenant fulfilled in this day and age. So this is why Paul says what he does with the old is growing old. It's ready. It's ready to vanish away. But it's not there yet. It's not there. And I will warn you, most modern translations use the word obsolete. Certainly isn't what the Greek expresses here, promotes. The Greek says it's waxing or vanishing or growing old, ready, but not there yet, ready to vanish away, ready, but not there. Turn to Matthew chapter 24 now. This is a real common question. Matthew chapter 24 about Yahshua's return. And a question on Yahshua's own messiahship, his own ability to prophesy. Matthew chapter 24. Take a look at verse 34 with me. Matthew chapter 24, verse 34. Says there, verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be fulfilled. Now Yahshua here says that all these signs, all these prophecies will happen before this generation passes away. What about the man of sin here, the false prophet? What about wars between nations and kingdoms? What about earthquakes? What about famines? What about all the signs that history says never happened in this first generation or has yet to happen? What about all these signs? Yahshua said that all these things would come to pass in that generation. What about the discrepancy? People use this passage to question or criticize Yahshua's authenticity as a Messiah. They say, look, he wasn't the Messiah. He was wrong. He was fallible. But is this the case? Is there another explanation? The word generation in the Greek, and again, we need to look deeper than the surface. We need to look deeper than what we find here in this book. Sometimes it requires going to the Hebrew, going to the Greek, going to different sources. The word generation is number 1074, generic, in the Greek. It means a generation by implication and age. The KJV translates this word as age, generation, nation, or time. So Yahshua could have said here, these things will not pass away until this age. These things until this nation. We don't know what he said for sure, but we certainly know that there's an explanation here. Most people either lean toward age or nation. I personally believe that Yahshua might have said nation, referring to the Jewish people, referring to the Hebrew people there, saying that this nation will not pass away until all these things be accomplished, reassuring the people, Yahweh's people, then and there, that they would remain a nation through all the tribulation, through all the horrific trials that they would go through. It's a promise, I believe, to the nation of Israel, that they would remain a nation until all these things occurred. Now, some people say age. And we don't know for sure what Yahshua said here. He could have said nation. He could have said age. Age fits too. This age will not pass away. This period of time will not pass away until all these things be accomplished. But again here, the word generation does not convey the message Yahshua was trying to. We find here that there is an explanation, that Yahshua was not fallible, that Yahshua knew what he said when he prophesied Yahweh's word, that he understood it, and he was right when he spoke. And we can count on that prophecy. So again, this passage is not something that we can use to criticize Yahshua's authenticity as a Messiah. So many people do. Yahshua was not wrong when he said this nation or this age. We just don't know. But again, there is an explanation that many people never see. Let's turn to Romans chapter 14. Romans chapter 14. Paul, you know, Peter warned about Paul's writing. Peter warned that Paul could be difficult to understand. Peter even said that some twist Paul's writings to their own destruction, which we see every day in this nation and the world. They twist Paul to negate Yahweh's law, to negate the requirements. Paul never did this. Paul never promoted these foolish ideas. Paul upheld the beliefs of his forefathers. We can find that in Acts 24:14. Romans chapter 14, verse 5. Says, one man esteems one day above another, another esteemeth every day alike. Let each man be fully persuaded in his own mind. Now, most denominational worship will say that Paul is speaking about a day of worship here. But is this the case? I remember years ago, Elder Allen and I discussed this passage with two ministers, and no matter what proof you presented, they were simply obstinate. They would not relinquish the fact that this does not convey a day of worship. They simply would not relinquish that idea. They held on to it. But is Paul saying that we can worship on any day of the week? Well, that's what they propose. That we can worship any day we choose, as Paul's saying, that we have the authority to change the day of worship. You know, Yahweh, he set apart the day of worship all the way back in Genesis. First thing he did, he hallowed the Sabbath, he rested. He set the example. He said, this is what you are to do and when you are to do it. But we know even through church history that this never changed for the first or second century after Yahshua's death. But what day did Paul worship on? I guess that's a question we can ask. What day did Paul, do we have evidence of Paul worshiping on Sunday or maybe Friday like the Muslims do? Do we have any evidence of Paul worshiping on any other day but the Sabbath? Well, let's find out. Turn to Acts. I want to take a look at the accounts of Paul's days of worship here. Acts chapter 13. Acts chapter 13, look at verse 13. It says, and after the reading of the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue sent unto them, saying, ye men and brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say on. And this is on the Sabbath. Then Paul stood up and beckoning with his hand said, men of Israel, and you that fear Elohim, give audience. The Elohim of this people of Israel chose our fathers and exalted the people when they dwelt as strangers in the land of Egypt. And with a high arm brought he them out of it. And he goes on throughout his message. Drop down to verse 42. It says, and when the Jews were gone out of the synagogue, the Gentiles besought that these words might be preached to them the next Sabbath. So here we see not only Jews, but we see Gentiles there worshiping on the Sabbath in the synagogue and commissioning Paul to come back next Sabbath to preach again, to elaborate again on Yahweh's word. Verse 43, now when the congregation was broken up, many of the Jews and religious proselytes followed Paul and Barnabas, who, speaking to them, persuaded them to continue in the grace of Elohim. You know, here he's in the grace of Elohim. He's still worshiping on the Sabbath. And the next Sabbath day came almost the whole city together to hear the word of Elohim. Where was Paul? Again, he was there in the synagogue on the Sabbath. On the Sabbath. Turn to Acts chapter 16. Acts chapter 16, verse 13. And on the Sabbath we went out of the city by riverside, where prayer was wont to be made. And we sat down and spoke unto the women which resorted thither. So again, we find Paul worshiping on the Sabbath. Not on Sunday, not on Friday, not on any day other than the Sabbath. Turn to Acts chapter 17. Acts chapter 17, verse 2. And Paul, as his manner was, custom was, this was what he did. This is how he worshiped. Went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scriptures. What Scriptures, by the way, were they using? The Old Testament. New Testament was not in existence at this point. He was using the Old. And he was doing it three Sabbaths, three continual Sabbath days, 3 weeks. He was there preaching, elaborating from Yahweh's word. So if Paul worshipped on the Sabbath, which you know, the evidence is he worshipped on the Sabbath, what was Paul talking about in Romans chapter 14? What was he referring to? Let's find out. Turn back to Romans. Romans chapter 14. And if I can get there. Romans 14, let's read verse 5 one more time here. It says, one man esteemed one day above another, another esteemeth every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. Now verse 6 here. He that regards the day regards it unto Yahweh. And he that regards not the day to Yahweh, he does not regard it. He that eats, eats to Yahweh, for he gives Elohim thanks. And he that eats not to Yahweh, he eats not, and he gives Elohim thanks. This passage is not talking about a day of worship. It's not referring to a Sunday worship. It's referring to a day of fasting. We know that it was popular for the Jews at this time to fast one day a week. Some did more. But they had different days. It was a personal issue. It was something they decided on. themselves. It wasn't written in stone. It wasn't something that Yahweh commanded, thou shalt fast on Wednesday or thou shalt fast on Sunday. It was something that they chose. And that's all that Paul's saying. He's saying, look, don't criticize. If somebody wants to fast on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday, they're fasting to Yahweh, and they should give Yahweh the thanks. And he says, if you don't fast, you should give Yahweh the thanks. Either way, he said, give Yahweh the thanks. He says, don't worry about it. He was saying the same thing in the first part of this passage about those who decided not to eat meat. So don't worry about it. Some will and some won't. And that's all that Paul's saying here. He's not referring to a day of worship. There's absolutely no evidence here to suggest that what we find is a change of worship. It's not a change of worship. Let's turn to another passage here, 1 Corinthians chapter 16. This is also dealing with worship. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. Look at verse 2 with me. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 2, it says, and upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store, as Elohim hath prospered him, that there should be no gathering when I come. Now, some will say that this passage shows that Paul recognized the first day of the week as the day of worship. After all, we do again see Paul commanding that they take offerings on this day, or so it seems. Number one, the word day was added. The Greek simply says the first of the week. This could have been Monday, could have been Tuesday, could have been Sunday. We don't know. Could have been any number of those days. And number two, there's no indication that it's referring to a tithe or religious offering. There's no indication here. There's no indication. Matter of fact, this passage, like we found in Hebrews, indicates that this offering was for brethren, was for fellow believers in Judea that needed help. They needed assistance. And Paul's saying, store what you can for those in need. Now, how do we know this? How do we know this? We don't from verse 2. And that's why we have to go beyond verse 2. We have to go beyond verse 2. And verse 3 says, and when I come, whosoever you shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. Why? Why Jerusalem? Why the liberality? Their grace, their gifts. That's what the word means. So why their gifts to Jerusalem? What was occurring in Jerusalem at this point of famine? Turn to Acts chapter 11. We have historical, scriptural evidence of this. Acts chapter 11. And we're going to look at verse 27. Acts chapter 11, verse 27. It says, and in these days came prophets from Jerusalem unto Antioch. And there stood up one of them named Agabus, and signified by the Spirit that there should be a great dearth or famine throughout all the world, which came to pass in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, every man, according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren that dwelt in Judea. Now we know even Paul consulted the people of Galatia. So Paul was looking for help. And it says in verse 30, by also they did and sent it to the elders by the hands of who? Barnabas and Paul. Same two we found in 1 Corinthians 16 too. Same two, Barnabas and Paul. This passage that we found in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 has absolutely nothing to do with a day of worship. Again, Paul was asking for donations. He was asking for help. He was asking for supplies for fellow believers who were in need. And we can find this historically, scripturally. The evidence is here. There is nothing in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 to indicate that this passage is speaking about a day of worship. But there is evidence after evidence showing that this was for supplies. This was a need because of a famine, because of a dearth. And the fellow brethren, their fellow believers were in need. And that's what Paul is talking about here in 1 Corinthians 16. Again, nothing to do with the first day of the week. Again, remember, the day was not there. It is not there in the Greek. Simply says first of the week. Many people don't realize that. But if you pick up the Companion Bible or another Bible, the show's words that were added, you will see there that word day was not in and is not in the original. Let's take a look at one more passage dealing with the first day of the week. Acts chapter 20. This is a real common one. Acts chapter 20 and verse 7. And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. So here, supposedly, or many people will say, that we have Paul on the first day of the week. He's preaching. It must be a service. Here Paul is worshiping on Sunday. On Sunday. Now, besides knowing that he worshiped on the Sabbath, and we saw example after example of that, it was his custom to worship on Sabbath. How can we explain this passage? Again, number one, the word day is not here in the Greek. The Greek simply reads on the first of the week. We can go even a step further, and we will find out that this word week in the Greek is sabbaton. Sabbaton. It means a Sabbath or the time between the two Sabbaths is what the Greek word means. In this passage, this word sabbaton is referring to a count. Very special count. It's the count to Pentecost, the count to the Feast of Weeks, something we will be engaged in here shortly. The first of Sabbaton is referring to the count, the first Sabbath, the first week to this feast day. I'd like to refer to the Companion Bible. Dr. Bollinger, in his Companion Bible here, points out that this reference is speaking about the count. Here's what he says. First day of the Sabbath, that is the first day for reckoning the seven Sabbaths to Pentecost. It depended upon the harvest, and it was always from the morrow after the weekly Sabbath. Now notice that, pay attention to that. The weekly Sabbath, and that's indeed the truth, the weekly Sabbath when the wave sheaf was presented. So, according to what Dr. Bollinger says in his Companion Bible, this is indeed speaking about the count to Pentecost. Now, I know most of us are familiar with this count, but it's good to review. So let's turn to Leviticus chapter 23. Leviticus chapter 23. I want to review this so that we understand what Paul's talking about here, what really Luke, he was the writer supposedly of Acts. Leviticus chapter 23. And look at verse 15. This is speaking about the count to Pentecost. And he shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete. So what we find here is the day after the weekly Sabbath, during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, because the Feast of Unleavened Bread commemorated what? The wheat harvest. And it was at this time that they would cut the wave sheaf. Feast of Weeks is wheat. But here we find when they cut the wave sheaf that they counted seven complete Sabbaths from the morrow that fell, the morrow after the Sabbath that fell between the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And they counted seven complete weeks from that point. So the Sunday that falls within the Feast of Unleavened Bread, they would offer the wave sheaf and count seven complete Sabbaths. They would start that Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Sabbath. They would start it all over again. They would do this 7 weeks. And they'd have 49 days, 7 weeks. And then in verse 16 it says, even unto the morrow after the seventh Sabbath shall you number 50 days. And ye shall offer a new meat offering unto Yahweh. And again, the Pentecost was for the wheat. It was for the wheat harvest. So we find that they counted seven complete weeks, starting at the morrow after the Sabbath during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then on the 49th day, they counted one additional day, and that was 50. And that's what the word Pentecost means, 50. 50. So we find here, this is the count of Pentecost. And we know Paul was keeping the feast days in the New Testament. We're going to find this. Turn back to Acts. Acts chapter 20. Look at verse 6. And we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and came unto them and tore us in 5 days, where we abode 7 days. So there Paul was for 7 days, keeping the feast of unleavened bread. And now verse 7, and upon the first of the week, or the first of the Sabbaton, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. Verse 16, for Paul had determined to sail by Ephesus because he would not spend the time in Asia, for he hasted, if it were possible for him to be at Jerusalem the day of Pentecost. The day of Pentecost. So here we find this count, the first of Sabbaton, the first count to the first week to Pentecost, falls between when? Falls between unleavened bread and Pentecost, just as we find in the Torah, just as we find in Leviticus chapter 23. The context is here to support it. Verse 6 is speaking about unleavened bread. Verse 16, we find Pentecost. And between those two points, we find a count of the weeks. And it was, again, a count to Pentecost. It was not that Paul was worshiping on the first day of the week. Simply was not the case. Let's move on to the eighth passage, Matthew chapter 24. Let's return to Yahshua's Olivet prophecy. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 40. Yahshua said, there then shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left. And most people believe that this points to a rapture, the rapture. But is this what Yahshua is speaking of? What did Yahshua mean when he said one is taken and one is left? Where does the one taken go? Most people will say to heaven. But is that the case? Remember context. We must understand the meaning of the entire passage. Drop back to verse 37. Verse 37, but as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days of Noah, before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also be the coming of the Son of Man. Then shall two be in the field, the one is taken, the other is left. Two women shall be girding at the mill, the one is taken and the one is left. Watch therefore, for you know not what hour your master doth come. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. So Yahshua says, as were the days of Noah, as were the days of Noah, so shall be my coming. Now what happened during the days of Noah? Can anybody tell me? It's real simple. They died. People were eating, they were drinking, they were giving in marriage, they were distracted. They were doing everything but what they should have been doing. And as a result, they drowned and they died. This passage is not speaking about a rapture. It's speaking of a time of judgment, a time when Yahshua will return to judge mankind. The one who is taken here is taken to his or her death. It's not taken to heaven. It's not taken to some sort of remote place for safety. They're taken to their grave. They're taken to their death, just as in the days of Noah. Turn to Luke chapter 17. It's a parallel passage. A little bit easier to understand. Luke chapter 17, verse 30. Or verse 26, I'm sorry. And as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it also be in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise also as it was in the days of Lot. They did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they builded. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. So Yahshua here, his coming is compared to the story of Noah. We've already reviewed that. They died. And Lot. Now what happened to Lot? Fire and brimstone. Sodom and Gomorrah. These two cities were destroyed, utterly destroyed, because of their sin. Likewise, when Yahshua returns, he will strike down the wicked. He will do the same. Yahshua said that when he comes, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. He is not coming, as many people believe. He is coming with authority. He is coming with power, and he is coming to reap the sin from this earth. When Yahshua returns, it will be a horrific time for the wicked and for those who refuse to acknowledge him. Turn to Matthew chapter 25 with me now. Matthew chapter 25 and verse 46. Yahshua says, "There and these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal." Now, is this passage saying that the wicked are punished and tormented forever and ever and ever and ever? We need to take a deeper look than what we find here. Punishment in the Strong's is 2851 Colossus, and it means to punish or torment. The root word is 2849 Coadzo, means to curtail or to dwarf, to chastise. So what happens when something's dwarfed or curtailed or cut off? It doesn't exist. It does not exist. What happens when you cut down a tree? That tree no longer exists. The same thing will happen with the wicked. When Yahshua returns, they will forever be cut off. They will forever have no more existence. They will forever be cut off. No different from Sodom and Gomorrah. They will forever be cut off. Turn to 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. We can refer here. This is somewhat of a parallel passage to what we find. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. Verse 8. "And flaming fire taking vengeance on them that know not Elohim, and that obey not the evangel of our master, Yahshua Messiah, who shall perish," now listen to this, "who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of our master and from the glory of his power." So it says here that the wicked will be punished with everlasting destruction, not everlasting torture, not everlasting torment. Destruction, no different, again, from Sodom and Gomorrah. The word destruction here is from 3639 in the Greek as olethros, to ruin, death, or punishment. Again, the Thayer's Greek lexicon defines this a little bit better. It says ruin, destroy, death. And then it draws the analogy with the flesh. It says, "For the destruction of the flesh, said of the external ills and troubles by which the lusts of the flesh are subdued and destroyed." Now, when we destroy the flesh, we destroy the flesh forever. We don't bring back the flesh. We destroy the flesh. And that's what this word means, to destroy. Again, according to Paul, the wicked won't suffer everlasting punishing or torment, as many people believe, but will suffer everlasting destruction. They will no more have any existence or being. They will be cut off. Turn to Jude. This is a key passage when speaking about eternal fire. Jude chapter, or it's only one chapter, so Jude chapter 1, verse 7. It says there, "Even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire." Eternal fire. Jude says here that the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah suffered eternal fire. Now, where are these cities today? Where are they? If these cities suffered eternal fire for their abominations, surely we would have evidence of their location now. But what do we see? What do we find? We find nothing. We find nothing. We find a land that is totally and completely desolate. That's what we find. Barnes' note says this. It says that the destruction of the cities of the plain with their inhabitants was an entire and perpetual, as if the fires had always burning, the consumption was absolute and enduring, the sinners were wholly cut off, and the cities forever rendered desolate. That's what eternal fire means. It's forever cut off. When Yahshua refers to the everlasting punishment, this is the punishment he's referring to. The wicked, as so many believe, won't be tormented forever. Instead, they will suffer destruction and will forever be cut off. Now, I'll be honest, I've never understood nominal worship's concept of punishment in light of how they view Yahweh's all-loving, all-compassionate, all-benevolent nature. I just don't understand it. In other words, on one side, Yahweh is all love, he's all compassion, he's all merciful. But on the other, he's this vindictive and cruel mighty one who will watch somebody burn and suffer forever and for eternity. I just don't understand. Why? Why would Yahweh allow this? Would not a loving and merciful mighty one simply destroy the wicked instead of making them suffer forever and ever and ever and ever? And do we even understand the concept of forever? And that's what people believe, that these poor people, they're going to suffer forever. And it blows my mind. Turn to Revelation 14 with me. I'd like to close with Revelation 14. Revelation 14, verse 11. And the smoke of their torment ascends up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night, who worship the beast in his image, and whosoever receiveth a mark of his name. Now, I want to point out, number one here, the severity of those who receive the mark. It's not something we should take lightly. Yahshua said through this prophecy that those who take this mark will be destroyed. Will be destroyed. It's not something we can, from all evidence, even repent from. Once we do it, once we're branded with that mark, Scripture says that we're doomed. And I'm only reading what Scripture says. But here John says that the smoke of their torment, those who receive the mark, will ascend up forever and ever. Now, notice that this does not say that their torture is forever and ever. Their smoke, the smoke of their pain, which is what the word torment means here, the smoke of their pain. It's referring to a type of remembrance, no different from Sodom and Gomorrah. The smoke went up, and they suffered eternal fire. They're not burning today. The Adams Clark commentary says that this passage is an allusion to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. In other words, the same type of destruction that the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah suffered, those who worship the man of sin, those who receive his mark and his name, will suffer the same. I was kind of surprised to find this quote here from the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary. It says, "The medieval idea of devils tormenting men and men blaspheming Elohim forever is unscriptural. Every word of rebellion shall be eternally silent. It'll be cut off. Every act of evil repressed." Again, in the same way that the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed and suffered eternal fire, those who worship the anti-Messiah will suffer eternal destruction, eternal punishment. Again, Yahweh is not a cruel and vindictive mighty one who would watch someone suffer forever. Think about this for just a moment. Would you wish this type of torture, this type of torment on your worst enemy? Would you want to watch your worst enemy forever, for eternity, roast in a pit of fire? Would you? Well, I know I wouldn't, not even for my worst enemy. Why would Yahweh then? Why would Yahweh want to see this? What purpose beyond inflicting unimaginable, cruel, and horrific pain would this serve? Scripture indicates that when we're cut off, it's an eternal destruction. It's not that we burn forever. It's not that we are in misery forever. Scripture doesn't say this. Would it not be better to simply destroy the wicked in this case, put him out of the misery, as Paul said, and then cleanse this earth once and for all from its sin? And that will happen when Yahshua does return. It's important that we understand passages like the one we have here and the others we've reviewed so that we know the truth of Yahweh's word and aren't deceived. You know, Paul said that we're again to study, to show ourselves approved unto Elohim, a workman that needs not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. This is an obligation you and I have as believers. It's not an obligation we can choose to ignore or disregard. We should embrace this obligation and make it a goal to study so that when Yahshua does return, that we can hear these words. And those words are, "Well done, good and faithful servant," something he's promised in his word, that when he does return, and we're found worthy, those are the words we will hear, "Well done, good and faithful servant." So may we hear those words May we look forward to this day. And may we work so that we're never deceived. May Yahweh bless you.